Good morning. Up right now on 94.7 WPVC-LP Charlottesville, it's the Mind and Heart Show. For the next hour, it's thoughts and feelings and the way they affect our lives and the world we live in. The phone number in the studio is 434-284-9470. Now here's your host, Dr. Jeffrey Frazier.
Good morning, Charlottesville, and welcome to the Mind and Heart Show on WPVC 94.7 FM, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. I'm Dr. Jeffrey Frazier, your host. Thanks for joining us this morning. We deal with all matters of the mind and heart, and this morning we'll be dealing with a relevant topic, so I'll introduce our guest in just a moment. But please join us by visiting our Facebook page, Mind and Heart Show. You can send us a tweet at @mindheartwpvc. Or email us at mindheartwpvc@gmail.com. You can also stream the show live this morning at our website, which is 947wpvc.org. And the show in entirety will be on sevillepodcast.com beginning tomorrow. So if you're unable to stay with us the whole hour this morning, you can pick up the show starting tomorrow at sevillepodcast.com. I'm very pleased this morning to welcome my guest, Dr. David Waters, a colleague and a friend, and really one of the more senior psychologists in the area. Dave's going to talk to us today about his work and his professional interests. So welcome, Dave.
Thank you very much, Jeff.
Tell us, if you would, just to get started, a little bit about your professional background. I always like the listeners to know sort of how you get to this point in your career.
Okay. Well, I finished graduate school in 1971, and it was a hugely turbulent period in the development of therapies, particularly interactive therapies like family therapy. So I was one of the first people ever to get any actual training in graduate school in family therapy, because it was really family therapy really began in the late 60s, in the turbulence of the late 60s, the move away from older models, particularly psychoanalytic models of non-interactive.
One person in the room with you.
Exactly, and lots of silence and waiting and so forth, and didn't fit me very well. I was lousy at it because I was too active and engaged, and one of my supervisors said to me one time, that was a good interpretation. A play therapy supervisor said that was a good interpretation, but 6 months too early. And I thought I was supposed to wait 6 months to say that.
And you trained at Emory University, excuse me.
Emory University, that's right, yeah. in Atlanta, yeah.
Right.
So when I came out, I got I had this family specialty, family and adolescent specialty, and it was very much of interest. And I had an offer from the University of Virginia to come and join child psychiatry here, so I did that. But I was very engaged in the whole family therapy movement for many years, and
right.
That was the main thing that I wrote about and taught and
practiced.
Loved and practiced, and really had the combination of the change in the times and my active presence. We really had a pretty active, pretty amazing impact on the psychiatry department, which began to look into all kinds of interactive psychotherapies and to move away from the pure psychoanalytic model.
And you really began a study group here in those early days of other folks. I mean, that it was such a seminal effort on your part to bring this approach to Charlottesville.
That's right. There was a lot of interest. There were a lot of people who were sort of knew more or less as much as I did, but were interested in sharing it. And we used to meet evenings. I would never do that anymore. But we used to meet, 7 to 10 one evening a week or two evenings a month, kind of stuff. It was a lot of excitement. So it was a period of a lot of change in the field, and that was really a very major focus for me. I went from psychiatry at the university to family medicine, where I was teaching family docs how to think and work in psychological and family-based terms, and I was at the university for 37 years.
Wow. So backing up one question, if we could, just tell us a little bit about your decision to become a psychologist in the first place. I think that's always an interesting question.
Yeah, well, it was very interesting. I really wanted to be a psychologist. I just didn't know it until I started taking courses. I happened to go to a college that had very good offerings in sort of clinical work. I went to Harvard, which has
a wonderful
a major called social relations, which is about clinical psychology, social psychology, sociology, all the interactive kinds of stuff. And when I found that major, I knew from the first course on that this was what I wanted to do. Yeah, I was home. Yeah, it was really what I wanted. I loved it. I loved all the readings and the challenges, and the, I loved the personal exploration. It was just very, very rewarding to me. Really fun. So I sort of stumbled into it.
You know, one of your legacies here is the Family Stress Clinic at UVA, which continues after your retirement. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about that, and I know you alluded to it with the family medicine, but I think tell us a little more about it, because it's such a terrific program, and it's been so important in this community.
Yeah. Well, I stumbled into it a little bit. So when I went to family medicine in 1975 from psychiatry, they very much wanted me to come there and work in that with them, but they didn't really know how to use me very well. It was a medical specialty. They didn't have a lot of time or energy for learning therapy, learning counseling kind of stuff. So I needed a way to really grab their interest. And so I got psychology graduate students to come and work with me. And we put in a one-way mirror. And we had a therapy room with a one-way mirror and a room behind it where I could
observe.
Or they could observe me, depending. And then I could kind of teach and coach and, you know, help them. So that was a very popular experience for psych grad students who were trying to become clinicians. And it was a great way to teach. And we also could make, with patients' permission, we could film what we were doing and then teach from that and so forth. So it just was a very lively way of teaching. And people had, and so when the residents came to work with me.
Family medicine residents
came to work with me. I could observe them with difficult cases of their own or with cases that where people would ask the kinds of questions they would ask of their family doc. You know, I can't get my 4-year-old to go to bed. And I don't know what to do about it. Or my twins, are, you know, the 10-year-old twins are beating each other up the whole time. Or, you know, and things that they wanted to be able to be helpful with. They could, you know, they would never dare to do much of that on their own. But with me behind the mirror or in the room with them or with them watching me do it, then they got a sense for, wow, this is something I can do and it's a contribution I can make.
Wonderful.
So it's going strong in the same format. It's a one-way mirror. They take on very difficult cases, and they can really be very helpful with them. They get really good training. It's great.
And it's somewhat unique, really, for family medicine residents to get exposed to family therapy and dealing with difficult families. I mean, I think mm-hmm. that it's been such a rich addition to their training there.
Oh, very, very,
and
yeah.
And folks that come out are just such better physicians.
They really are. It really is great for them. And we get it. It means that the program here, the family medicine training program here, gets people that are actively interested in learning more than just the medicine. They want to know how to relate to people effectively and how to help families.
Yeah. So for our listeners who don't really know exactly what family therapy is, can you just give us a thumbnail sketch in a few words?
Family therapy was a radical, really radical invention when it came along in the late 60s with the idea that you could usefully have the whole family in the room together and talk about what was going wrong. And the basic idea was that it's not about some person in the family being messed up or being the problem.
What we call the identified patient.
That's right. The term went from being the patient to being the identified patient, which meant that it might be the 13-year-old who's acting up or making trouble, but it may very well come directly from one or both of the parents, from their
relationship.
Right. From a sibling that is, you know, acting out or, you know, abusing a younger sibling, that kind of stuff. So the idea was that as opposed to these things being all very internal and the 13-year-old is working out deep issues of her own kind of stuff, there's a very good chance that she is reflecting or he is reflecting the other forces in the family, resentments, fights. Quite a common finding was that as parents' relationships deteriorated, kids acted out more and had more trouble. So the parents would want to say, you know, she's all messed up. But when you looked at it, you could see that the relationship was very tense. the child could split the parents easily, could, you know, get the parents fighting with each other. Mom says, I can do it. Why are you so mean? Kind of stuff. That made the parents fight worse. That made the kid look more problematical. Anyway, so it was just a huge shift, almost 180-degree shift.
Sea change.
Yeah, away from what's going on in just inside your head to what's going on in the shared force, within the shared forces of the family,
yeah,
which are very strong.
Yeah, and that movement, which you said started in the late 60s, and the time since has just exploded. I mean, now there are subsets of family therapy. My own training with Monica McGoldrick was very, looked at a lot of ethnicity and gender issues.
Yep, very
again,
strong.
Within the family context. Mm-hmm. So it's just really had a huge impact on our field.
It has.
It
really has, yeah.
Or so, well, 50 years.
It was a counterforce to the original idea that Freud had, that all of this happens in our heads and in our psyches. And that's all that really matters, is what's going on, you know, what the deep forces in there are. And he forgot that things are also happening externally between people. People are molesting each other, beating each other up, or
freezing each other out.
Or drawing harsh boundaries or no boundaries. And let's look at the reality before we just take everything to the internal.
Yeah.
Big, big shift.
Yeah. And especially with kids, right? I mean, moving from isolating a child in play therapy to saying, wait a minute, he's 10, he's still wetting the bed. Let's look at what else is going on at home.
Exactly. Exactly. Right. Not with a punitive thing of, you know, let's find whose fault it is, but
right,
to say this is probably not, that we know this is not happening in isolation. It might be that he has a bladder infection that, you know, that we need to treat, but much more likely he's responding to something in the family, some that may or may not be, you know, malignant, but that is serious and that is affecting him a lot.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
You know, you think about you alluded to this, the evolution from sort of Freudian psychoanalysis to then some family, then we went to baby behavior therapy, cognitive behavior therapy. I mean, mm-hmm. You've really been, had a front row seat to that. As I have, that much difference in age,
right,
to that evolution.
That's right.
Just any general thoughts about that?
Well, the main thought I have about it is that we are now and always have been doing the best we can, but we're really kind of it's like trying to catch a black cat in a dark room. You know, we're fumbling around with the best we can get. I think that there've been a lot of very, very good attempts to improve therapy. Psychotherapy is way better than it was when I came out of training.
Absolutely.
Infinitely better.
I would
agree. I mean, I teach 25-year-olds who are well-versed in what I didn't learn until my 50s.
Yes.
You know, it's progressed very fast. I think right now, interestingly, we're on the verge of a huge revolution in being able to engage brain function very directly. That's
so neuroscience.
Neuroscience.
Neuroplasticity, which is the brain's ability to
make
changes structurally into adulthood.
Yep.
Yeah, that's exploding.
Oh, that's exploding. It just so happens that I've stumbled on or gone to watch, I think in the last 2 weeks, three or four different programs on TV, mostly on public broadcasting, but about manic depressive illness, depression, autism,
wow,
et cetera. There's one other that
anxiety
are...
Anxiety disorders, maybe?
Yes, anxiety disorders, right. That was the one. That are all about what can we do directly with the brain. No talking about it kind of stuff. That ameliorates those conditions significantly. Yeah. I'm glad to say they all of the people who do those things, and I've investigated it fairly carefully, all the people who do those things say all we can do with the brain is to get the systematic barriers out of your way. You still got to make your life work. So
exactly.
We'll take off the parking brake. You still got to drive the car. It would be a good idea keep being in therapy and thinking about how do I make my life work the way I want it to. Yeah. So it's not at odds with therapy.
So it's your sense that it's not going to replace what we do. It's going to maybe be a supplement what we do. Or
that's right.
Help what we do even.
Oh, dramatically.
Yeah.
Dramatically. And for some people, it will be a very significant, essentially a cure. I mean, you know, the best brain treatments right now for depression have dramatic results.
Yes.
And people can can get out of a depressed state quite quickly. So.
And then we're talking about medication, we're talking about diet, we're talking about, you know, substance abuse, we're talking about nutrition, physical activity. I mean, it really is holistic in the sense it's
exactly
the whole person.
That's right. Right. Relationships. You know, all of those things go together, and there's just a lot of things to consider and work on. And
it's very exciting. I mean, I've talked to some neuroscientists, and it's just amazing where all this is going.
It is. And we're at the stage, we are with neuroscience right now where we were with computers in about 1975, which is that we have this fabulous new instrumentation, but it's big, it's expensive, it's clunky, it doesn't work perfectly. In 10 years, we're going to have... It's going to be the difference between a mainframe computer and the phones in our pockets, you know, that it's smaller and lighter and faster and better pointed. And we're going to make some significant changes in that, I think.
When you, in all the years you've done family therapy, I mean, would you say they're presenting problems that more lend themselves to that approach? I mean, were there sort of categories of things that would come in the door and you'd know, boy, this needs a whole family intervention?
Yeah. I tend to think, Jeff, that most behavioral problems with kids belong in family therapy.
Okay.
Most of the time, even if it's not the family isn't causing it. Okay, let's say that you have a child who is innately very anxious, and that happens. Okay,
yes.
You have kids with high anxiety levels.
They come into the world with a higher threshold.
Right, and the mother will say, you know, he was always
a fussy baby,
and he never knew, he could never relax very well, and he was terrified of the dog when he was a toddler, and you know, couldn't go outside on rainy days and that kind of stuff. So you're looking at somebody with a significant endogenous situation like that, how the family deals with it, how people respond, how people help him or don't, how the siblings may work around him or isolate him or her, that kind of stuff. I think that it's always a useful contribution to be working with that, at least in part, in a family format that says we're a team, we all have to, you know, work with this together and not get into blaming and not get into shaming. And so
or dumping it all on the kid and sort of saying, here, fix the kid. He's the problem. We're all okay.
Right.
How
nothing
often do we see that?
Well, a lot. That's right. Ill intent. It's just the best people understand.
That's what people do.
You know, our other kids are fine. This one's really anxious. He's the problem or she's the problem. Well, yes, you may have a very different organism, but how we work together, how we take care of him or her as parents, as siblings, how we respond to that is very important.
You know, and then you get these situations with a kid like that who's very intuitive, and they're picking up all this other stuff in the family and tension between the parents. And you can just see how the wheels can come off very quickly.
Very quickly, yeah. And having those wheels be addressed interactively instead of just solo. Now, that same kid might very well profit also from some individual work with a therapist, learning how to calm himself or settle herself down or not take a combative posture with siblings when they're upset. You know, some kids that are very anxious will... Anything a sibling does will make them furious and upset, and mommy, he's doing it again kind of stuff when the brother or sister isn't doing anything or nothing much. It's not a matter of who's right and who's wrong. It's a matter of how people fit together.
Yeah. If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Mind and Heart Show on WPVC 94.7. I'm your host, Dr. Jeffrey Frazier. My guest this morning is Dr. Dave Waters, and we're talking about all matters of therapy. And we will be back in a couple minutes. We're going to take a short break, so please stay with us. My guest this morning is Dr. Dave Waters, psychologist in Charlottesville, really one of the deans of our profession in town, and someone who has had a very positive impact on the field and on training folks to do this kind of work. So I want to welcome you back again, Dave.
Thank you very much.
So we were talking before about different approaches of therapy, and sort of your evolution as a therapist. I wanted to ask you, excuse me, a general question about what do you think the sort of most important aspects of a successful treatment, the so-called, you know, nonspecific factors or even specific factors, if you will. What works?
What works? Well, I think it's the research on that over the years, Jeff, has been pretty consistent and pretty strong, which is that what works, what makes the biggest difference in therapy is a solid, safe, comfortable relationship with the therapist. The opportunity to talk to somebody that you can come to like and trust and have a good feeling for and who you definitely feel has that for you, the opportunity to talk about the things that are hardest to talk about, most confusing, most upsetting, most difficult, without feeling ashamed, embarrassed, uncomfortable, is extremely good for people. I mean, one of the things that's interesting is that there are lots of researchers. There's a lot of research to show that the expression of difficult material, difficult feelings and thoughts, to somebody in a comfortable relationship changes bodily function. You know, your GSR gets galvanic skin response, the lie detector kind of response,
right.
Normalizes your breathing, regularizes your blood pressure, goes down. There's something innately we are, as people like to say, we are wired to connect.
Yes.
Our brains are wired for connection. And when you
we
are social creatures. And when you have a good connection with somebody and you can really relax into that connection and talk about things that are hard to talk about but that are bothering you, it's very, very good for people.
Yeah.
So far and away, the biggest nonspecific factor is just the quality relationship and that therapists are trained to listen and engage in a way that encourages that makes that work well.
Yeah. You know, I think of that, and you know, so often you will hear folks in treatment talk about the safety of my office, the safety of your office, the fact that this relationship is unlike anything they've ever experienced in terms of, you know, the intimacy of it, even though it's one-sided. And they're really talking about what you just said in terms of a sanctuary, really, to come in there and sit across and be heard and for someone to get them. You know, people will so often say, no one ever got me before. My parents didn't understand me.
Right.
You seem to get me.
Right.
And that would be such a pivotal moment in treatment.
That's right. That's right. That sense of you understand exactly, or not exactly, but you understand how I work, and you still seem to like me.
You don't go screaming out of the room when you hear
that. You seem to like me and respect me. You don't see that as something terrible about me, just as a human function. It makes it easier to talk about, et cetera. It might, I don't know if I should say this on the radio or not, at 73, I'm in therapy. I have a therapist. Not because my life is not working well. It's working extremely well. But there are always things that come up that it's really helpful to have somebody that I can go and say, boy, I'm stuck here. Or this really amazed me how strong this reflex was. Where does that come from? Why am I so reactive to that? You know, when at 73 with a good life and everything.
Successful career.
Right.
Yes.
Why would anything bother me? Things always bother people.
Of course.
So that's the heart and soul of therapy.
Yeah, I agree. You know, I think you would agree, though, that for me it was always a greater challenge to get men to open up than women.
Much.
You know, men can be so tough because of they were socialized to be, you know, don't cry and be strong and suck it up and
And there's, for men in particular, this happens to women too, but for men in particular, there's a lot of shame around the softer emotions, but even about not being effective. That is, if a man feels, boys are raised to, if you don't score a goal, if you don't do the best, if you're not, you know, if you don't make the tackle, whatever the thing is, there's shame and bad feeling about that, regardless of if you did your best or not, and so forth. So, men often learn how to be often come out of childhood with a lot of shame around emotion and around softer feelings, and makes it very hard for them to work in
Yeah. And you know, the irony for me was always that, you know, these guys that would be so tough and they, you know, been in war zones and stuff. And to me, the real courage always came with them being able to open up to the softer side of themselves.
That's right.
You know, they could do the macho stuff fine, but boy, they were terrified about about the vulnerable side.
That's right. That's right. Nothing was too scary for them except sitting still and thinking about what they're really feeling and telling somebody about that.
And some of us have been there. You know?
Yes. Yeah.
Even in our field.
Yep.
So let's talk a little bit about your current clinical interest. I know this is something I really wanted to have you address because it's so fascinating to me in terms of what I've recently learned of your current interest or one of your current interests.
Good. Well, my work these days, Jeff, I retired from the university in 2008. And I went downtown to practice and teach. I joined a big practice that had a lot of young therapists learning and needed a lot of supervision and training called CLT, Charlottesville League of Therapists, which closed in 2011. But I'd been there for 3 years by that time. But I also, always from the beginning, I did some work for them, but I mostly had my own practice downtown. And I knew that in finishing my career with a private practice, that I really wanted to do better therapy than I'd ever done because I'd always been a kind of a generalist a little bit. I taught family therapy, I taught couples therapy, I taught individual therapy, I taught, you know, theory courses and, you know, did a lot of supervision and stuff. But I had never really been a full-time therapist, and I really wanted to see if I couldn't be a really good full-time therapist. So partway through that, about in 2012, I stumbled on the work of a woman named Diana Foscia, who has a system of therapy called...
She's a psychologist.
She's a psychologist.
Okay.
Yep, she's a PhD. And she has a system called Accelerated Experiential Dynamic Psychotherapy. Big, ugly
name. Mouthful.
It's a mouthful, and it's not even very descriptive mouthful. If you're going to have that big a mouthful, it should be a little bit more. It doesn't tell you much of anything. And I won't even bother with, is it accelerated? Is it experiential? But anyway, her way of working is very, very strongly focused on the emotion that guides our behavior and the deep understanding of that emotion, the real, really deep pursuit of emotion in therapy and helping people really master, really make use of their enormous number and complexity of emotion. So it's emotion's an interesting thing. I mean, the cliche of all therapy is, how do you feel about that? As though we're always dealing with feelings. But if you watch therapists closely, what they do is they ask the question, how do you feel about that? And maybe the responder says something, it makes me really sad. And the therapist then goes off on, I think you're sad because, you know, you never had that worked out. You know, goes to a purely cognitive understanding of it. And
pretty intellectual, too.
Yeah, intellectual and
a feeling level.
Not a feeling level, right. They don't pursue the sadness, the experience. They don't help people really stay with and relax into those emotions as important things. They start to explain or try to fix it or whatever. In AEDP... the focus is very much on the rich shared experience of emotion that can help people understand very powerful elements of their own functioning. Almost all of our behavior emerges from emotion.
Emotions,
you know, that emotions are the problem, really. If it was all cognitive, it would be easy. Somebody would come to me and say, I'm having a hard time relating to my husband because he can be mean to me and I don't know how to talk to him, and I could give them three things to say or whatever, and we would be done.
Yes.
And it doesn't work that way at all. I mean, that
it's not that clean. Emotions can get messy.
Very messy. And emotions mean that, so I could say to somebody, why don't you say to him, I don't like it when you talk to me that way. It doesn't feel respectful or loving. Please talk to me differently. Okay. Now that's a nice clean thing. And 90% of, if I'm talking about this particular interaction, 90% of women are going to say to me, I can't say that to him. either I don't feel like I have the right, or it will infuriate him.
Yeah.
Right, he'll infuriate him and he'll explode. Or I was taught that it's my job as a woman to make a man feel better, not to challenge him, or, you know, emotional things that get in the way, emotional things that lead to cognitive ideas that get in the way of a straightforward relationship. So if it was all cognitive, it was all in the prefrontal cortex and just a matter of, you know, kind of making good decisions about, oh, I see, I never thought about that, I'll say that to him. Well, if she does, his own emotions are going to be triggered and he may very well explode, or he may very well be completely befuddled by it and upset and hurt and angry.
Or
shut down, go away, you know, call her names and get
storm
away
around.
Because his emotions can't cope with it. Emotions are where the trouble comes from. So this was a very specifically emotionally focused therapy where I, as I watched her work, which is how I got started, I went to a week-long training with her and watched a lot of her videotapes and a lot of her work and could see that she was just extraordinarily good at sticking with the emotional realities of a person and helping them be comfortable with those. And with remarkable results. And so I thought, okay, if I have 5 to 10 years left to practice, this is how I want to practice.
Interesting.
And so I made it my business to really learn, and I read a lot. I went to a lot of training. I became a rookie at age 71, I guess it was.
Good for you.
60,
we never stop learning. Good
we
for
never
you.
Stop learning. And I actually love learning. I love, I mean, I say it as though it's a big sacrifice. I love, I'm happy to be a rookie.
It energizes you. I've known you and I know how you get energized by ideas and this kind of newness of
exactly
this.
Right. You're exactly right, Jeff. I do. I love the idea that I'm onto something worthwhile and interesting and good. And
that's why you couldn't retire completely.
That's right.
65 or something.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. Way too much mental energy.
Way too much left to learn.
Right, right, right. So I just sort of thought, okay, I'm going to stop being a generalist. I'm going to really focus here. And I've worked very hard on it. As I say, I read a lot. I go to a lot of training. It's like being an apprentice in something that is enormously rewarding to do. You know, oh boy, I'm finally going to learn how to make horseshoes, or you know, fix wiring. You know, and I can wire anything, kind of stuff.
Yes.
That sort of sense of competence and accomplishment is delightful to me. I love feeling like I really get it.
You know, in my own work, not in this paradigm, but it's working long term with folks with emotion, I think we also have to be very astute observers. I have to be able to observe that a very subtle change when I say something and you say something, that I can catch that, and then I can use that to say what happened just then, or what's going on right now.
Exactly.
I think that is part of a
very much
okay,
very much yes. That you're exactly right. That kind of very fine tuned awareness.
Yeah.
So that I can often know before the person I'm talking to, before the patient knows, I have a sense for there's something powerful going on here. And I can help them slow that down and look at that and really stay with it. So it might go.
And maybe even give it a name, which they haven't had for it before. Oh,
right.
I think such
right.
and such.
Right. Right. Although actually I'm less interested in giving it a name than in increasing the experience of
okay.
it. The naming is more cognitive
it is,
and
right.
more intellectual.
Yeah. Yep.
And so I'm much more apt.
It could also be a distraction, couldn't it?
It could be.
Name
yeah.
It. Yeah.
Yeah. If I say, boy, I think you're really angry at your dad, that pushes a person into a very specific
corner,
idea
yeah.
of or experience of what that is. And then they have to either try to get to where I am or persuade me to get to where they are.
Yeah.
I'm much more apt to say, so stay with
that. Stay with how that feels.
Stay with how that feels. Tell me what comes to mind. Help me understand what your experience of this is, because I could see that you really darkened when you said that. There was something very heavy and hard about that for you. What is that, as opposed to, I think that's how you feel when you remember how your dad treated you or something like that.
Yes.
I'm much more interested in that's the experiential part of it. It's a very experiential therapy in terms of deep feeling in the context of our relationship.
Okay. You know, I've often kidded, although it's probably true, and you may have heard this, that the capacity to be that attuned, to be that present, I know in my own life, comes from having a sort of unpredictable narcissistic mother who always was trying to kind of read the tea leaves. And I think in some ways we learn as therapists through some relationship such as that, to be a more finely tuned machine, if you will.
Yeah.
I'm sure that's completely teachable.
Yeah. No, that's right. There's very different levels of awareness of it.
Some of it we can certainly learn. Yeah. But
Mnuchin used to say, Salvador Mnuchin was the father of family therapy. The greatest family therapist ever, I think. He used to say the best training to become a family therapist is to grow up in an enmeshed family.
Yes.
Where enmeshed means everybody very much in everybody else's business.
And the emotions are all complicated and sticky and blurry.
Right.
I sneeze and, someone else catches a cold.
Right. Or the famous example is I get gas and you burp. that there's so much connection between people that people are reading. So if you grow up in that kind of a family, you're actually going to be very good in the family therapy room at reading other people's responses. Yeah. The equivalent here is, you're right, that not just a sensitivity, but an enjoyment of the sensitivity to what other people, liking to figure out what other people are feeling.
It's a puzzle.
Yeah, and to be involved in that.
Yeah. In those families, it's sort of like, I know what you feel. How do I feel? It's like, I know how you feel better than yourself.
That's right.
See that.
That's right. Yeah.
So how does this approach, I'm guessing it differs in some significant ways from cognitive behavioral therapy or classic psychoanalysis or whatever. I mean, what are some of the markers there?
Well, some of the markers, there's two or three things that distinguish AEDP, Accelerated Experiential Dynamic Psychotherapy. There's two or three things that differentiate it. It's very much based in attachment theory, which is a very powerful way of looking at what happens to us as we grow up. And it has to do with a couple of major variables. The two major variables of attachment theory, the two major things that happen in a good attachment between mother and child, are that the child feels very safe and very protected and like the world works around them. And the other is the co-regulation of emotion, that the mother helps the child manage their emotion and manage their feeling and feel like we can figure this out. So that
like soothing a crying baby.
Exactly. Soothing a crying baby, or if a child falls and is frightened by it, not hurt, but frightened by it and gets up crying or running to the mother, the difference between picking them up and saying, "That scared you, didn't it? Isn't that hard? It's, you'll be okay," and kind of taking the baby in versus, cut it out. Just suck it up. You're fine. Don't
bother me.
Don't bother me with this. You got to learn how to fall down and get back up and keep going, and pushes the child away. So, and it's not even as simple as that you always have to do the one or the other. There's times for both. But for the most part, that experience of that is how we learn to manage our emotion is in the context of a healthy relationship with a parent, with parent figures, and others around us who help us absorb and understand and deal with what we're feeling in healthy ways. That's why emotion, it makes so much trouble later in life, is that that's not easy to do.
They haven't learned to self-regulate.
Right. Even good parents make serious mistakes of that kind.
Yeah, it's tough. So, we're going to take another short break, and we'll be back with this discussion in just a moment, so please stay with us. So welcome back. We're here with Dr. Dave Waters, and we were just talking about some of his current work using a school of therapy called AEDP, and he was talking about attachment, the attachment theory piece. So maybe we could spend a few more minutes on that, Dave.
Good. So what that means in practical terms in working with people in AEDP means that part of my job is to become a really good attachment figure for them, that I provide safety and comfort and ease in kind of addressing things, that I help them regulate the emotion and understand the emotion, and that we work through the emotion together in a way that feels safe and comfortable and helpful. And that they can experience new parts of themselves with me in a way that is often very difficult for people. That is, give you an example from my own life. I what got me back into therapy a while back was that I found myself feeling very competitive and at odds with colleagues, friends, I could feel that there was this sort of upsurge of if somebody was doing well, there was a part of me that wanted to do better or put them down or get away from it or whatever.
Yes.
And I thought, wow, that's what's that about? And I didn't really know how to sort through it because it was an uncomfortable thing for me. It felt bad. I felt some embarrassment about it and some discomfort with it. That was kind of how I got started back in therapy. But so that kind of experience is very hard to sort out for yourself. It's very difficult if you're really having the same problem over and over. You can't find your way out of it. I mean, a young woman came to me a while back and said, all my relationships end the same way and it's not good. And I have no idea what I'm doing or whether I'm picking the wrong guys or where this pattern comes from. But I can't even really think about it. I can't. All I know is I think it won't happen this time and then it happens again. So it's a perfect example of, very few of us can find our way out of our own dilemmas without some help.
We're too close to it. I'm thinking of one person I dealt with who I would call anxiously attached. And in that, what that means in the context for our listeners is they never feel secure in their relationships with others. And right. So she would continually not speak up or exercise her own wishes because she was afraid of rejection and so forth. And so this was a pattern that was obviously causing her great difficulty. That would be perhaps an example.
Exactly. Right. Very good example. And so to help her sort back through the origins of that and make some sense of it, one of the interesting things about my work that I've actually always believed, even before I sort of was able to codify it or make more sense of it with AEDP, is that all of our problems begin as solutions.
Yes.
All of the things that go wrong for us were originally to protect ourselves. So to go back to my example, I grew up in a very competitive family, and I grew up with four brothers and a sister, all of whom were fighting for limited resources, and all of whom learned how to put each other down and keep each other in their place. So I really learned that very strongly. And that was,
it was a survival strategy.
It was a good survival strategy.
Yes,
I had to learn how to do that.
You didn't collapse. You didn't shut down.
Nope. I fought for share, right? But I did it in not very helpful ways, and I had no idea what I was doing.
Correct.
But it was so people who are, let me see if I can think of a good example. People who have the problem of not trusting others probably grew up in a situation where trust was not a good strategy because people weren't trustworthy.
And they were betraying
betraying the trust, and they needed to learn from early on, don't trust, don't let this person get too close, et cetera. Then the situation changes. You're married, let's say, to somebody who's very trustworthy, who really loves you, who wants to be close to you, and you can't just drop that strategy. Those strategies get in at a cellular level. People learn those things before they even have words for it.
Yes.
So it's very hard for people to then just think, oh, yeah, no, I don't need to be that way anymore. I think I'm going to switch that over. I'm not going to be untrusting anymore. That just
doesn't happen.
You don't have that kind of control.
You can't think yourself out of it.
You can't think yourself out of it. You didn't think your way into it. You got into it by survival reflex, so you can't think your way out of it.
Yeah. One of the things I'm guessing happens, and tell us if this is so, is that very often those patterns will start to play out with you during their sessions so that if there's a trust issue, you may find them being tentative with you in terms of opening up or whatever.
That's right.
It gives you right in the moment.
Right in the moment. That's right.
Speak to that.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's exactly right. That part of what's useful about a really good if you can forge a good relationship with somebody, is that those same kind of things, they begin to experience very immediately with you.
Invariably, right? I mean, you see it again and again.
Right, right. Those reflexes aren't voluntary, and so they can't say, oh, well, this is a therapist. He's not going to criticize me. I don't need to protect myself against him. That happens very, very naturally. So to ease that relationship in a way that makes people able to feel like, well, I think I want to try something. I want to try something with him, or I can say, I think you're feeling unsafe here. I think it feels like if you tell me about this, it will feel bad. And they say, yeah, right.
The light bulb goes.
Light bulb. Yeah, right. You're right. Why is that? Why? Because I don't think you would tell anybody. I don't think you would laugh at me. But I still don't want to tell you. And then you can look at it very much in the in that microcosm.
Yeah. Yeah. I wonder, too, because this is something I used to see, if that kind of work is really going on and it's really progressing, then they go home and the triggers are the same. The partner is the same. And so how does that carry over?
Well, it carries. It's a tough one. That's a good question. There are times when the problem is so interpersonal that it keeps being activated at home in that kind of a way, as opposed to intrapersonal. But I think part of what happens in good therapy is that people get better at relaxing into their own reality and letting themselves feel what's real and not being critical or punitive with it or angry about it or whatever. So it becomes more possible for, let me go back again to my example. So if I've been being competitive, and part of being competitive is if my wife says something corrective or you know, critical, I could flare and
get your back up. Yeah.
Right. Get my back up and, you know, kind of counterattack. Kind of, well, you're not perfect yourself. Or, you know, I suppose in 50 years I've never done anything right. That old speech that every man makes.
Been there.
Every man's been there. But in the experience with somebody new of feeling like I can put this out and feel what it feels like, I can make sense of it, I can start to make peace with it, that can carry over at home as well, so that in time I can say to my wife, wow, when you say that, I can tell I'm getting really kind of defensive and stuff. Let me think about this for a minute. Or just even saying it slows the action down and gets me out of my reflex reaction and into something more thoughtful and more measured that says, you know, I can only hear that as I don't like you, I don't love you.
Yes.
You know, and she can say in all seriousness, that has nothing to do with it.
Right.
You know, you spilled jam. You didn't clean it up. Now we have ants. That's a problem.
Right.
But that doesn't mean
you're a bad person. Right.
Right. Doesn't mean you're a bad person. Doesn't mean I don't love you. Doesn't mean I wish I had never married you. You know, and by being able to notice that that's where I go with it and that that doesn't make much sense, then we have the chance to kind of rework it between us. And I can, most importantly, I can renegotiate it with myself.
Yes.
In the sense of being able to say to myself, this is something I bring that doesn't fit. The problem there is that we are reacting from situations that are long gone, but the reactions don't change unless you do something to change them.
Yeah. I'm reminded, and this is something that's happened in my own life, that very often as men, I think if someone says to me something which hurts my feelings, we tend to convert that immediately into anger,
mm-hmm.
you know,
right.
as guys.
Mm-hmm.
And how hard it is to say, instead of getting angry, say, boy, that really hurt my feelings. Mm. I mean,
that was harsh. Are you
getting guys to go there? Because you can often get them to recognize that the anger is preceded by the hurt.
Yeah.
But then the willingness to then say that.
Yeah, because the anger is allowable. We have a category for that. You know, you don't mess with me.
That's right.
And, you know, ball up
bring
your fist
on.
And, yeah, bring it on kind of, or, you know, or say something harsh and dismissive to get rid of the discomfort. That's okay. You know, yeah, he's a tough guy. He's an angry guy. But then to say, you know, it just feels really bad when you say that. I don't understand why you would say that to me, because I don't think it's true. Feels, you know, wimpish and, you know, weak. So forth when it's a much more accurate reflection of what's happening.
Yeah, yeah. And so that's, again, would be the kind of thing if you were working with an adult male or even a late young adult male that might come up. I mean, mm-hmm. they say, I'm always flying off the handle.
Right.
And you could begin to look at where that's coming from.
Right, right. And that it has all of those kind of problems have natural origins that we can understand and that we can accept and make sense of. You know?
And as you said earlier, that at one time were an attempt at a solution.
Absolutely. Yeah, the best solution you could come up with, right? If your father is a scary guy, then you learn to, you know, make certain kinds of accommodations to manage that might work in that situation, but that then mean that you end up treating a lot of people as a scary guy in a way that's not very helpful.
Yeah, yeah, it's really interesting. The whole emotional piece, it's just so. We've only got a few minutes. I wanted to ask you a little bit about training new therapists and how do you see as you work in supervision? I mean, are you looking at some of these issues or is it more broad-based?
No, my supervision these days is very much from this point of view, really helping people to get better at the using attachment theory, the deep exploration of emotion. The third piece, there's, when I think of it, there's sort of three pieces and I think of. Emotion is one and attachment theory. The third one is that AEDP is a very positive therapy. It basically takes what you do well and builds it.
Interesting.
It is absolutely not interested in pathology. I never talk about pathology anymore. It's just not a useful concept for me.
Interesting.
I don't think it's a useful. I've never thought it was a very good way of thinking. Part of my work, the book I wrote 20 years ago was called Competence, Courage, and Change, and was about the fact that everybody's doing the best they can the whole time, and that most of us are doing amazingly well. So AEDP specifically builds on what works. So if somebody says to me, for example, I really adored my kids, but I don't think I did a very good job raising them. I'm much more interested in the adoring than in the bad job.
Interesting.
Okay.
Yeah.
I would ask much more quickly, what did you love and how did you love it? How did you know that was the experience? What was your experience with them? How did they love you, et cetera? To root people in their most positive, most the best of themselves. I mean, we all have a self at best and a self at worst.
Yes.
And our job as therapists, generally, my job as therapist is to help people move from self at worst to self at best. And
because there's so much self-condemnation, and especially in our culture, self-criticism and shame around all these issues.
Absolutely.
I mean, that just weights people down.
Right. People don't know how well they're doing until they and I figure it out together. I mean, people will say, you know, I didn't do very well this week, and then list four things that were really very good adaptations, and be very surprised when I say, what are you talking about? That's amazing. That was a lot. They say, oh, you're right. That was different, wasn't it? And you know, that's what I'm interested in, is that difference.
So. You know, Dan Siegel, a psychiatrist out in California who's interested in some of these same things, will say that our brains are like Velcro for the negative and Teflon
for the positive. That's right.
You know,
that's right.
Really grab onto the negative.
We do.
And the positive just kind of taken for granted.
Yep. And very often when I have a positive feedback for somebody, or I'm saying, you know, that was really good, or I love the way you're thinking about that, they will sort of try to stop me, say, you don't have to pander to me, you know, I think you're just trying to make me feel better, or it's very hard for people to take in the positive.
Yeah, and I think that's something we all see, you know, as therapists, especially in this culture. I think there's just so much of this sort of rugged individual thing, and you got to be tough and get through it.
Right. I shouldn't need a lot of support and help. I shouldn't be expecting people to be kind to me or, you know, sensitive to me or whatever. No, that's right. I mean, how many people, and this is an interesting question for our listeners to ask themselves, how many people out there have a hard time just taking a compliment and really enjoying it? I think that's almost a universal experience, that so many people push a compliment aside and sort of feel
shucks,
like you're just saying that, well, it was, I just got lucky or that kind of stuff.
Yeah. So any closing thoughts for us? This has been a terrific interview and I'm so grateful for you coming in and sharing some of this. Just any closing thoughts you would leave us with about what we talked about?
No, it's enjoyable for me too, Jeff. Thanks very much. The closing thought is that I would just have people, I would love to see people feel that therapy can be a really rich and highly enjoyable experience. I mean, people sort of don't come to therapy until they're miserable and feel like, you know, life is over and nothing's working kind of stuff. Good therapy can be such a rich addition to your life and as I often tell people, it should be fun.
Yeah.
And people look at me like I'm crazy the first time I say that. Yeah. This is not fun.
This is like a root canal.
Exactly, right. But I'm not a dentist and it ain't a root canal. And we don't need anesthesia.
Yeah.
So give it a chance. Give it a try. If it can be so so rewarding and so enjoyable.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Dave, for coming in this morning. If you've joined us late, you've been listening to the Mind and Heart Show. I'm your host, Dr. Jeffrey Frazier. My guest today has been Dr. David Waters, talking about his career and some specific types of therapy. And I think it's been a really wonderful overview of that. So thanks so much, Dave.
My pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
See you soon.
Enjoyed it.
Great.
Thanks.
Take care.
You've been listening to the Mind and Heart Show with your host, Dr. Jeffrey Frazier. Be sure and tune in again next Saturday morning at 9 o'clock for another edition of the Mind and Heart Show, only on WPVC-LP, Charlottesville.